high school program versus an intensive outpatient program? There's one big social factor.
I feel like someone trying to harm themselves or others needs to be inpatient.
Well, but there's a big social factor that determines.
People who have a support network at home.
Like dependency or something?
Vulnerability.
Okay, think about it. They're being discharged from the hospital. Did we send them to a partial hospital program where they have to go and stay all day? Or do we send them to an intensive outpatient program where they're monitored closely, but, you know, they have to meet regularly, that can kind of make their schedule and everything?
So they have to be competent.
Why? It's a big factor.
They have to be competent mentally to be able to do it, and, okay, I don't know.
It's a social factor.
Now I'm confused.
Are they working?
Yeah, they can't function.
Are they in school?
Oh, that's too basic to think about.
Big responsibility. If they have a job they got to go back to, and they're expecting them to be at work, are they going to be able to go to a partial hospital program all day?
No.
Okay. But so an intensive outpatient program would be more reasonable. Okay. Because there's a commitment, and they have to make so many meetings and keep followed up on that type of thing. So yeah, perfect example. Somebody's suicidal, came into the hospital. They're not suicidal, but we're still very concerned with them if they're living at home and don't have a job or school responsibilities. Yeah, you betcha. We're gonna put them in a partial hospital program. Okay, that makes sense.
Okay, so the main determining factor is whether or not it's their outside responsibilities, like their daily life, like having to go to work or go to school.
That's a big key issue. Okay. Yeah, because we want what? What's the main thing we want no matter where they go?
Recover and be able to function at the highest of their ability.
Which is what kind of environment?
Least restrictive.
The least restrictive.
Okay.
Okay? Y'all got it.
Okay.
Now, you know, there's crisis care. Some areas have a 24-hour crisis care unit, you know, that can help stabilize the patient and everything. Ochsner's kind of does. They have a pre-psych area before they go up to the 10th floor. And sometimes the patient can be stabilized enough in that pre-psych area to where they're not fully admitted to, you know, the floor. It just depends on their circumstances and what happened and that type of thing.
So crisis care or crisis intervention is usually like short-term brief interventions,
mm-hmm.
but it can also be the 24 hour.
Well, or they're available 24
they're available
hours.
24 hours.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, here typically at the other facilities, it's going to be an 8-1-1 emergency room, like at Wilson Island or somewhere like that. But y'all got it. It's recovery oriented. And once they're discharged, you know, we want that continuity of care. We want them to be able to follow up and receive the care that they need that was initiated and established while they were inpatient. Or, you know, if it was an outpatient psychiatric office and they're sending them somewhere else, you know, that continuity of care is key there. And that's really what that chapter's about. Did y'all have any other questions on it?
And like the other exam, the style of question is going to be the style of the prep use.
My study guide will kind of get you to key in too, but those preppy questions are to help you because that comes straight from the text.
Yeah.
And anything I lecture on in those voiceovers is for from the text.
Okay.
Okay. I'll emphasize things, but like I might mention partial hospitalizations briefly, or Miss Hart may, but not really get into it. Well, we mentioned it. It's a good idea to go to your book and read in depth about them.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying? Because that'll kind of help complement what we're trying to teach y'all, because we got so much to cover.
Well, I mean, in the sense that, like, when you get into the upper level of the prep use, it's a application of what you're, so this is what we're looking at, the application of it.
I just gave you application right at the beginning, didn't
I? Okay. Yeah, so I was just, because the lower level ones aren't like that, but once you get to, like, level 7, 8, it's more application of what's going on, so that's where we're at with the style of question. Okay.
Yes. Every once in a while, there'll be a, you know, no-brainer.
You need those in
there. And the basis, either you know it or not, a knowledge question, but it's, when those are there, it's generally very, very important. That's something that you need to make sure you know. Yeah, because you're going to see it quite often. But, yeah, most of them are application-type questions. Chapter 6, know those code of ethics, autonomy, beneficence, justice, non-maleficence, paternalism, ferocity, fidelity. Okay? Know what they mean.
What's the difference between paternalism and
benevolism.
Paternalism is like, you know, you getting a physician's emergency certificate.
Okay.
Someone is deciding your care.
Okay.
In the healthcare arena. Beneficence is just the good for all.
Okay.
You know, you want to do the best for everybody. And that's autonomy and beneficence. Those are the two main concepts, because sometimes that's our main ethical struggle in healthcare. Because, like, if you have a patient that refuses to take their medication because it makes them feel bad, okay, well, that's autonomy. We want to give them autonomy, but we know if they don't take it, they could start acting out and have symptoms. So the nurse is thinking of the good for all, you know, the beneficence. And that's why those are the two major concepts in this arena. Okay. And y'all know what the others mean?
Like, veracity is truthfulness. Fidelity is like faithfulness.
Loyalty. Mm-hmm. What's non-maleficence?
Cause no harm. Do no harm.
What'd you say?
Do no harm.
Mm-hmm. Y'all have seen the movie Maleficent? Maleficent? Okay. All right. So, also, you know, what that chapter talks about, that key factor of the nurse, okay, this chapter and chapter 9 kind of talk about it. That self-awareness that the nurse needs to have, okay? Because you have to know when you're going in to treat a patient, your biases, your feelings, okay?
I'd be aware of them.
To effectively be able to care. Because you may be forced in a situation where if there's a, you know, you can step out because there's enough people to step in and replace you, you may need to do that. But you're being self-aware and knowing that that's not good for you to handle because it disagrees with your ethical beliefs or concepts. Okay? And then it just talks about, you know, the basic professional performance as a either a psychiatric RN, and then you have your advanced practice, okay, RN, you know, there's differences in those roles. And a nurse should perform within their scope of practice, you know, don't go outside your scope of practice. And it talks about some of the organizational are the organizations that are out there, like the ANA, American Psychiatric Nurses Association, those type of things. And they're there to protect us, okay? But they give us standards by which to follow and work by and that type of thing, okay? So, and just be aware of them because you're going to be hearing them in the future. And it's good just to know, like ISBN, what is ISBN? Who are they? Well, they're the International Society, okay, of Psychiatric Nurses. So, and those, you know, code of ethics are the main thing about that chapter and understanding them. And that's how we practice by. It kind of introduces the biopsychosocial model. Okay, y'all know what I'm talking about that?
The biologic domain, the physical and like the psychological.
Mm-hmm. And social.
Is it psychosocial?
That's how we practice. Mm-hmm. We follow that model. Biological, the psychological, and the social. So biopsychosocial. So if we're looking psychiatric nurses, which one of those is the most key component with them?
The psycho.
Okay. So, and you'll be learning more about that model, because everything that we talk about, when we talk about anxiety, when we talk about depression, when we talk about, you know, we talk about the different ways it can affect the biological. You know, depression can make them lose their appetite. They're not eating. You know, mania with bipolar can make them very hyperactive. They're not sleeping. They're not eating. You're looking at that biological concept with them. Then you look at the psychological concept. How are they feeling? What are their emotions? Is their behavior, basically, from the outcome of all this? How are they thinking? You look at that psychological domain, and you use the mental status examination to cover that. And that's introduced more in chapter 10, I think. Have y'all had 10? I can't remember.
You've posted 10, 11, 12. Are you going to post the other three?
Don't get posted this week. I just don't want to post all of them too soon and overwhelm you. But
will the date of the prep you for 25 change? Because I think it's like in 2 days or something. It's due.
Yeah, it's like 8 a.m.
I did it.
Yeah. Well, I haven't gotten the PowerPoint and all that stuff yet, so I hadn't done it.
The 25 prep you is due Wednesday at 8 a.m.
Yeah, but we haven't gotten the, you know, the lecture or anything like that on it. I mean, I guess I could have just read the chapter independently. But
you could have just done like that.
Next exam.
I didn't have this type of time.
Okay, let me go look at all that, and it will change.
Okay.
If need be. Yeah, it will change. I'll let y'all know. I'll send you a message.
Okay, thank you. Come on, Tricia.
Okay, anything else about that chapter?
I think you covered what stood out to me. 8 was on the last test.
I think it's nine chapters.
And 26.
Okay.
25's on exam two?
That's anxiety.
Thanks,
guys.
It's just not posted yet.
The whole thing's
anxiety.
Okay. Well, then, if it's on your second exam, you know, I don't know if you're trying to prep you.
The second exam isn't it's next Wednesday, but the prep is due this Wednesday.
It's due this Wednesday.
Yeah, because everything got shifted, I think. I don't know. I'm very confused. Everything's confused.
Okay, I'll look and see. It will be due
the
day of the exam. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I'm glad y'all brought that to my attention.
I don't have time between now and 8 a.m. on Wednesday to get anything done.
I don't know.
Trust me, I panicked last night.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, the psychosocial theoretic basis of nursing. Where we get all our basic theories. And it starts out, you don't have to really remember all these names.
Yeah, I was worried about that. That's a lot.
Yeah.
That go with it, except, like, first of all, the psychodynamic, okay, theory. Who stands out with that?
Freud.
Right? Mm-hmm. Y'all learned about Freud way back when.
And then,
okay, and he taught two of the big defense mechanism concepts that came out during that time was transference and countertransference. Mm-hmm. Y'all know the definition of those.
Can you kind of like explain the difference? Because I was reading in the book like the difference between them, but it doesn't make sense, the difference between those.
Okay. Tell me your name.
Kevin.
Okay, well, I apologize. I don't know all y'all get up. Okay, so transference. I'm a nurse taking care of Kevin. And I'm talking to him and I'm dealing with him. And Kevin comes to really, really like me and seek me out and want me to care for him because I remind him of his mother. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's transference, the patient to the nurse. Countertransference is I'm taking care of Kevin, and he's an alcoholic. And my dad was a bad alcoholic and beat my mom every time he got drunk. And so I have a bias already going into my relationship with him and caring for him. Because it's a countertransference from nurse to patient.
Oh, so is that always kind of like negative countertransference?
Or not necessarily. A nurse can favor a patient.
Oh, okay.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And you know, just go out of their way for them because they remind them.
Oh, okay.
Them of,
so it's kind of like interfering with
right.
their care and not seeing them. Okay,
mm-hmm.
I get it.
So the
mm-hmm.
main point is that transference is patient to nurse, and counter is nurse to patient. And it can be positive or negative, it just, okay.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Okay.
So we talked about psychodynamic theories.
Okay, so what are your psychodynamic theories? Your psychoanalytical model, okay? That's where that transference, countertransference, and that's where your psychotherapy came into play a lot. Which you don't see a whole lot of now because, you know, think about those two terms and a patient laying on the couch and the psychiatrist saying, okay, tell me about your childhood, you know, and they're getting them to bring up everything, okay? Don't see a whole lot of that nowadays. It's still done, but it's very expensive and it's very time consuming. I know your TV shows are full of it. Okay, and then you have your neo-Freudian models, okay, and your humanistic theories. And the big humanistic theory is who? I know y'all remember Gestalt too, but who's the big one?
Maslow.
Y'all may have to revert back to Maslow's because y'all have had Maslow since y'all were infants. I might ask y'all something about which one of these needs, you know, which one of these that the patient is displaying to the nurse falls, you know, as the greatest need on Maslow's hierarchy of needs or something like that. You see what I'm saying? You're applying those models again to. And then know that the core of psychiatric mental health nursing, okay, the core of good psychiatric mental health nursing is a therapeutic interpersonal relationship with these patients. Now, next you have your cognitive behavioral therapies. And those are your stimulus response.
Like Pavlov.
Yep. Your reinforcement theories and your cognitive theories. And so it started from the cognitive behavioral theory.
What did you say the core of good psychiatric nursing is?
Therapeutic interpersonal.
Mm-hmm. So think about behavioral therapies. What are you trying to do?
Change
with
the way
behavioral
you,
therapies.
Change the way you
response.
Think.
Yeah.
Huh?
Get like a desired like result or
a positive response. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what population would you expect to see these theories a lot done a lot with?
Kids.
Children. Okay? You learn to raise your hand to ask a question. Mm-hmm. You get a piece of candy, okay? Your operant conditioning, you're making them rethink, okay? Before I blurt out the answer, I need to, that's the cognitive part. I need to raise my hand, behave appropriately to get that reinforcement. Y'all with me?
Mm-hmm.
And from this came the absolute cognitive theories, okay? And under the cognitive behavioral theory, and they still kept the behavioral component with it because the key to cognitive behavioral therapy is change the way you think, or change the way you believe, or change your perception of something to change your behavior for the positive. Y'all with me? And from this grew the developmental theories, okay? The social theories, and the interpersonal theories and your nursing theories that came about. So who's the big developmental theory person? Y'all had every semester in one sense or another.
Erickson.
So y'all might see an Erickson question. Y'all might have to go back and say, what stage is this person in? Based on Erickson, okay? Because it's important. You're going, when you go to the children's floor and you're dealing with a six-year-old, you need to think about that. As opposed to when you 2 hours later go and talk to a 10-year-old, you know, where should they be at based on Erickson? Are they there? Maybe they're behind. Okay, because that's going to affect the way they act a lot, the way they think. So that's going to affect their behavior, right? Okay, and then, you know, as far as the interpersonal theories, well, first back to developmental theories, you know, they look at normal growth. If everything develops like it should normally, well, then people should grow up pretty much okay and demonstrate good behaviors, right? Okay. So the interpersonal theories, you know, Pavlov was, not Pavlov, Pavlov was one of the biggest ones because she was nursing, and she's the first one that kind of brought about those stages of anxiety, meaning mild, moderate, severe panic, okay? But thought processes have a bearing on that behavior. The way they're thinking has an effect on how bad that anxiety can be. Because if we're not thinking at all and they're not clear-headed at all, that anxiety is going to be high. Because y'all remember what I told y'all? Did I tell y'all? The more anxious you get, what happens?
Doesn't your focus narrow?
You become smarter or dumber?
Dumber.
Dumber. The more anxious you get, the more stupid you get. I just use the word stupid. Because it sticks and makes people remember, you know. So if somebody's right there panicking bad on the verge of a panic disorder, what y'all think?
They're not thinking very well.
Is that a good time to say, okay, now calm down, let's get up and let's go to your room and let's calm down? And they're not there. And are they a danger to themselves?
Possibly.
Yeah, because they're totally irrational. They're not thinking clearly at all. So you have to use simple, you know, hey, look at me, look at me. You know, you have to be very simple and get them one step at a time, okay, to get them going. And that's taking control of how they're thinking to affect their behavior. So that's why that's part of that cognitive behavioral process. But those are the main things. It's just that chapter's trying to introduce you as to, you know, where did all this therapy and everything on how we treat people stem from? And you're going to have a whole complete different chapter on cognitive behavioral therapy. Okay? Because you're going to hear that over and over and over. So just right off the top of your head, without y'all having gone any further, which population of patients do you think cognitive behavioral therapy probably isn't suitable for?
Older people?
And kids.
Well, they're demented.
And kids.
Okay.
Very young children.
But can they think straight? I mean,
like schizophrenia?
Schizophrenics. Because that's a thought disorder. Okay? Yeah, schizophrenics. But yeah, you're right about the demented too.
The Neo-Freudian model, was there a particular person you weren't
definitely
with them?
Nah, main thing is knowing that falls in that psychodynamic. Okay? Sullivan was a real big one, but I'm not going to get, I know y'all been learning about him.
Of the theorists, you mentioned Pavlov, Maslow, do we have to know, and Erickson, Skinner, I know was mentioned, you know.
I threw out those names that I really wanted y'all to recognize because they've been around and, you know. But the main thing is knowing, you know, if you see this example, which theory is being considered.
Okay.
You know, if it's interpersonal relationship, having to do with interpersonal relationships, it's more of the psychoanalytical theory. Having to do with trying to get their behavior to change, just work on that behavior. Period, okay, is behavioral therapy, okay? Looking at how growth has an effect, growth and development on their behavior, it's specifically that developmental theory. You see what I'm saying? Okay, and that's it on that chapter, basically, unless y'all have any other questions. And what else did y'all say was on there? I don't have my calendar with me.
9, 10, 12. Communication and therapeutic relationships.
Let's talk about 9, 10, 12. Did you say 25?
25. 25, 26,
and
18. But those haven't been posted. Those haven't been posted at all, have they?
Yeah.
18, 25, and 26 haven't been posted. I'm just saying those are all.
So we could do that.
Yeah. Okay. Chapter 9. That's therapeutic communication. Again, that self-awareness, that chapter starts off talking about that. If you're going to be effective at communicating with these clients, you need to be aware of your bias and everything, first of all. Okay? And then know that you have a biopsychosocial self. Okay? You have a biologic dimension, a psychological state, and social biases. Everybody does. Communication, when we communicate with somebody, it's not just always verbal. A lot of our communication is nonverbal. So we always want our communication to be therapeutic. Okay? Verbal, you have to watch your tone. You have to watch your volume. You don't want to be condescending, okay? I'm very guilty of that with little elderly folks. Oh, how are you doing today, sweetie? Okay. And some of them love it. I'm not saying they're all offended by it, but you got to be careful. They might be. Nonverbal communication. You have to be aware of that. I'm sitting here talking to y'all like this. Mm-hmm. Constantly, do I look very engaged or, okay? So, you know, maintaining eye contact with that person is very important. If you see that they're not wanting to look at you, they may be scanning the room or something, you know, they're very distracted and you're gonna have a hard time. Sitting at their level, you know, not standing over them and dictating, all right? Know your blocks to communication and also those techniques that are therapeutic. I think they're on page 109 of your textbook. Like, broad opening statements, you know. That's a good therapeutic technique because you're saying, tell me about your day. That opens it up for them to tell you, to start talking. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, have you had a good day? I could just say yes or no. That's closed ended. Okay. Sometimes closed ended questions are appropriate, but if you're trying to get a broad opening response or not, okay? Because sometimes they go ahead and elaborate, but most of the time they'll just say yes or no. But those blocks are giving advice, okay? Mm-hmm. Don't ever want to give advice. Agreeing with the patient. So if a patient says, don't you think I need to go back to my husband? Instead of saying, yeah, I think you're right. I think you should go. What should you use?
I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah.
More of a reflective question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, what I'm hearing is you're thinking that maybe you should go back to your husband. Tell me about that. Mm-hmm. Okay, you see what I'm saying? Because if you agree with them, that may shut them down totally to, okay, that's it. And, you know, they don't think anymore on it.
That one nurse that one time told me I have to go back to my husband.
So I said, go back.
So you can't tell me nothing else.
He drank me down the highway, but that nurse said, go back. So I'm going back.
Be careful challenging the patient, okay? Giving reassurance. Oh, everything's going to be okay. You don't know that. Okay. And disapproval.
That's a big one.
Sometimes, you know, you have to correct a patient's behavior, like say they're cussing up a storm and around a whole lot of people, you know, instead of just saying, stop cussing right now. That's not allowed here. You know that. It's good to acknowledge the fact that, oh, wow, you seem pretty upset. You appear very upset, frustrated, but you know we don't cuss around here. We can't allow you to do that. You're acknowledging their feelings, accepting that, you know, they are having an emotion and a feeling. Okay? Now, what are some components of good, effective communication? What are those key components? Have y'all looked at chapter 9? Yeah.
Like rapport.
Okay. Very, very important.
Oh,
empathy.
Empathy was the other one.
Empathy. What is empathy?
It's like putting yourself in somebody's like shoes and trying to understand.
Trying to understand. That's the key. Because you don't necessarily have to have had experienced it, right? To have empathy. So what is sympathy?
That's what I was going to ask. What's the difference between empathy and sympathy?
You feel sorry. Sympathy is like feeling, sorry.
Oh,
sorry.
So bad that
that's all it is.
You
just feel
the
sorry.
Empathy is like, dang, what if that happened to me? This is how I feel.
Yeah,
but
it's
you're
like
trying
to understand.
Okay.
But, you know, a lot of times to people when they say something, we go, oh, I'm so sorry. You know, you're having sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
I struggle with sympathy.
But if you're having empathy, you're going, oh, Lord, that must have really been difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me more about how that made you feel. You're trying to understand. Okay?
Okay.
All right. And you also want to look at, okay, those empathetic linkages. Do y'all remember what those are? You got to be careful with those because it can be a block, but sometimes they're appropriate. Do y'all know what they are? What's an empathetic linkage?
I have not
like
done
if
this.
The patient just got a bad phone call that their aunt died and they're crying and they're boo-hooing and you start crying with them. Okay, you're empathizing that hard.
It's like crossing the boundary.
Right. And sometimes it's okay to cry with them, you know, or laugh with them, but you gotta be careful that it's appropriate time to do that. Another way for effective communication is knowing those boundaries. You gotta make sure you stay professional. And your space zones.
If one of your weaknesses is to start crying when other people are crying, like,
well, that's self-awareness,
it's,
right?
It's basically, does that mean psych is probably not for me?
No, that's because you know what you want to know. What am I doing?
Don't go work with the kids.
Going into nursing, especially psych nursing. Was I am very gullible.
Oh.
I want to believe what you telling me is the truth. Why else would you tell me that?
Oh,
if
wow.
You ain't telling me the truth, okay? So, but knowing that about yourself and everything, it can help you just be a little aware.
Kept putting too much water in it.
And I almost started crying.
And
my
eating all the
water.
Good stuff. That's what I'm saying. You
kept looking at me and I was like,
it's lost all of its like infusedness, and now it's
that's,
just a
that's okay.
Yeah, with a weird strawberry.
But you're gonna have to learn to compartmentalize.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid to learn to do that.
Okay.
Because it's a defense mechanism. A lot of nurses don't do it, or they're afraid to start doing it because they say, "Oh, I'm getting cold-hearted, and I don't care."
You have to do that for
yourself. Okay, to a degree. And you got to be able to move from caring from this individual to caring to another individual. So you use it adaptively, compartmentalization, you're using it wisely, okay? But that doesn't mean you can't go in that next patient's room and cry if you need to. Okay, so therapeutic communication is very important. You know, you'll have an example, which one is most effective to use in this case, okay? And you will have those type of things throughout, because you need to know how to be effective with communicating with somebody that's hallucinating, okay? Somebody that's having a delusion, somebody that's, you know, saying they want to kill themselves. Well, then you got to go straight to that concern about suicide. You got to just kind of skip over things and go straight there. Because somebody that's, have we talked about this? Somebody that's hallucinating?
No. We talked about it like in our first lecture.
Did we?
Or okay. Not first lecture, like our WebEx. Yeah, that clinical orientation. That's what it was called.
Remember, the hallucination is what?
When you see it,
right? Yeah. So this perception has nothing to do with the thoughts. I mean, it does to the degree that believe it.
But it can be anything.
You see, you hear, you feel anything.
So it's a misperception sensory of something that isn't there. So, oh, that must be very scary to see that. But I do not see it. You can validate that you can't see it, that you can't hear it. But start off by acknowledging their feelings. Okay, because it's very real to them. Whereas remember, with a delusion, that is more of a thought.
It's a misinterpretation.
It's fixed. Okay, they're going to sit there and argue with you all day. I don't care if you don't think the FBI is after me. I know they're after me. I'm telling you, they're coming right now. And they're going to argue with you all day because it is a fixed delusion.
Like delusion of grandeur.
Mm-hmm. So the best thing that you can do is distract them. Okay. Ooh, that must be, but you could still, ooh, think the FBI is after you? Wow, that must be scary. Come on, let's go over here and see what Kevin's doing. Let's go see what he's working on. You know, you want to distract them because you want to get them away from that thought and to thinking about something else, doing something else. But we'll learn more of those as we go down the road. Now, your defense mechanisms. Just, all I can tell you to do is, I'm not going to sit here and go through each one of them. If you have a specific question, you know, let me know if you're not really full of understanding one. But, you know, that can be adaptive. Because everybody has defense mechanisms and use them, but you need to look out for them. And you will see as we go to the disease processes that some use this, you know, quite often, while others use this one quite often. Okay? Because, I mean, just right off the bat, think about alcoholic. What are they possible for?
Denial.
Yeah. Oh, I'm quitting time. Oh, no problem. But I do want to point out projection and displacement, because those are two that are often confused. So what is projection?
I've put like a problem on you. So like, I have a problem, but then I just, like, you are doing this and you're doing that. Right. And so I throw everything off of me onto
right.
you.
I'm the one that's really mad and upset.
My husband does that in an argument all the time.
But the nurse was talking to me, and I say, why are you being so angry and upset at me all the time. I project it onto them, okay? So what's displacement?
Is that where it's like it's not their fault?
Right.
But not putting it on to someone else, but they...
You take it out on them. It's also known as kick the dog syndrome. You've heard of the employee getting mad at work, and they come home mad, and the dog comes up to greet them, and they kick the dog out of the way to take their frustration on the dog. That's displacement. They're displacing their anger or whatever to another object, not to where it should go, back at work. And then the nurse-patient relationship, look at that table 9.7. You know, you just basically have your orientation phase, your working phase, and your resolution phase. And if you look at that table and study that table, you shouldn't have any problems with that. Okay? But know that it's always goal-focused, okay? And it's about the patient, not the nurse. And time limited. And that relationships can deteriorate. Okay, and know that those phases of a deteriorating relationship start with holding, then you start avoiding, and then you struggle to make sense of everything because like when you've been in a friendship with somebody and it's finally over, you just, I don't know why I was friends with them in the first place, you know. So that's the big things in that chapter. Okay, and then y'all said chapter 10. That is the nursing process, basically. Okay. But you put the psychiatric component into it. And know that with, you know, the first thing that basically happens is an interview, a patient interview. So with an interview, you want to state your purpose of that interview. I'm here to get some past medical history information from you, you know. We're here to talk about specifically about your alcohol problem. What is the purpose of that interview? You should make that plain up front. But for just an assessment, what is one of the best first things that you can say to somebody to get it going?
Introduce yourself.
Well, introduce yourself, but question-wise.
Tell me about your day.
Well,
or how are you feeling today?
What brings you in today?
Oh, yeah, what brings you in?
Tell me what brought you here, okay? Because even if you get a report from the ER that they're suicidal, they came in suicidal, they come up to you, you don't go, I hear you're suicidal, okay? No, you want to start seeing their perspective. Tell me what brought you here today. That's the chief complaint. Okay. So know those biological things you look at. You like their appetite. It's important to know appetite. Like what if they have an eating disorder? What if they're manic and they're not eating? Sleep patterns. All those biological things. Has the lab in there. Y'all look at that lab chart, okay? Now, most of the time on psychiatric admit, doctors will get a basic CBC to check things out, a complete metabolic panel to check it. Y'all know what's all in that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thyroid function test. Why'd they get thyroid function test?
Endocrine.
Huh?
Like endocrine issues.
What could affect some
anxiety,
well,
how they're feeling.
Yeah, it can affect your mental state.
Can it can make you tired.
And get, make you confused. Isn't there confusion associated with
it? What can make you
it?
Tired?
Oh, if your thyroid is, like if you have hypothyroidism.
Okay, and what does that look like?
Low
mental disorder.
Depression.
You see what I'm saying? What would hyperthyroidism look like?
Mania.
Possibly. Okay. Hypomania. So that's why they do thyroid function tests. So, and y'all do have it straight that your TSH, is it going to be low or high if you have hypothyroidism?
Low.
Hi.
Oh, yeah. You made me question it. I was like, hi, and then you said low. I was like, oh, well, let me shut
Kevin
up.
Today.
Oh, girl, no.
I was like, well, you're
Kevin's
so much
a thyroid.
More.
Thyroid.
I've never looked at
it. Okay? He produces thyroid hormone. I'm the thyroid stimulating hormone. I'm the hormone that stimulates him. Okay? So if he's not working like he should, he's hypothyroid. What am I going to be doing?
Stimulating.
Keep trying.
Get your work. Hurry up, work. Do your job. Okay? But if he's overacting, okay, he's working overtime, he's a workaholic, what am I going to be doing?
Just sitting back.
You don't need no help.
I'm just going to sit back here.
Okay? I'm going to be low. So y'all don't get that confused. All right, patients get that. I mean, students get that confused all the time. It's a stimulating hormone. So I'm stimulating the thyroid to work. Also, they do drug screen, okay? Looking for what?
Substances like marijuana and methamphetamine.
What's marijuana reported as?
THC.
Okay. Now, what, this is one thing I want to tell y'all because you're going to see it in clinical, hopefully, and on the floor. What is the legal limit for alcohol in Louisiana?
0.8. We're going to kill someone. 0.08.
How is that reported through blood alcohol level?
In hundreds. I don't know what the exact number.
You take that number and multiply it by 1,000, essentially. So it's going to be reported as 80. Y'all with me? So I didn't want y'all here. I had blood alcohol level of 80 and think,
they're
dead. Oh my God. Because that's 0.08.
They're 80% alcohol.
Because y'all are going to get your levels like, they came in so intoxicated, their blood alcohol was 298.
That's still pretty dang high.
Okay, that's 0.29. You see what I'm saying? Okay. So I wanted to clear that up because I didn't want that to confuse y'all. And another test they do. What is the test for syphilis?
RPR.
Why do they do an RPR? And that RPR is not mentioned in your in that chart, and I don't know why.
Oh, because syphilis affects your brain in
that's
the late
right.
stages.
You get neurosyphilis.
Oh yeah.
Which it's makes you very psychotic.
And it's really high rates in Shreveport.
Thank you. That was the next thing I was going to say. And what is the number one communicable disease in Louisiana?
Syphilis.
Okay. All right.
Ew. Most people are so nasty.
And then your, another thing with the biological, their thermoregulation. Because when we talk about schizophrenics, okay, that
really
is off with them. So you will see them in the middle of winter walking downtown without a shirt on and shorts. And then in the middle of summer, you'll see them with a big winter coat on. Okay? And also, there's a disruption with the thirst center in the brain, and they drink. even though they're not diabetic, but they drink and drink and they can get water intoxication. Okay?
That's for schizophrenia?
Yeah. So that's why it's important to not forget about those biological things. Now, what's your mental status examination?
Not the Glasgow. No.
What does it include?
Affect, thought process, mood.
Okay, first of all, you want to see what has been responses to past mental problems. How have they responded? Okay, what was their success? And then your mental status exam includes just general observations. You know, did that patient come in disabled? You know, smelly? What are your general observations? Their orientation, their mood and affect, okay? Remember I told y'all about mood and affect, they go together. Their speech, is their speech pressured? You know, are they talking 90 minutes an hour and just, you know, that could be a key that they're manic. Their thought processes, their cognition, their attention, are they able to concentrate? Their abstract reasoning, how can you assess that?
Is it abstract?
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of those little mini tests. Like maybe the cough?
Abstract reasoning.
Comparing the two things.
What could you ask me?
Saying like the sky, like
the sky
is
blue.
So the and green. What? How does that one go?
Something yeah, like I know what you're talking about.
Tell me what.
Tell me what it means
by a crow or spilt milk.
Yeah, aren't you just trying to get them to eat riddles.
Tell me things.
Tell me what it means. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush.
I truly don't know
what it means. If you have a bird in your hand, you have it. Two birds in the bush, can you even catch those? Are you going to get them or are you going to end up with no bird?
No,
I mean, not that you want a bird. Those aren't yours.
Your
this
hand.
One you have, you have it.
So why do you want another?
So why are you the ones in the bush when you got one in your hand?
Yeah, don't try and get those and lose the one you got.
I'd probably try and
I'm thinking of having three birds.
Yeah, you thought you had three birds.
Like,
now you have
be
no
the
birds.
Dead horse.
Like you can't.
Don't be a dead horse.
Pour a little while in there and then, you know.
In Texas,
they
don't be greedy.
Concrete thinking, don't cry over spilt milk. Well,
I have cried over spilt milk. I have cried over spilt milk. I have cried over spilt
milk.
Yes.
Crying over.
I spent like an hour pumping. I knocked it over and I cried. I was at a conference and I just sat in the room and cried.
It's gone.
And then it's not coming back. And then I had to go buy formula for that feeding.
Right.
Mom problems.
Okay. Let's move on. If you think of your memory, you gotta do their short term memory, their intermittent memory, their long term memory. Their insight, okay, judgment, and then you're looking at their behavior, okay? Also, under this is their self-concept. What's their perception of their body image? Are they too fat? Are they too skinny? Their self-esteem, that goes along with their self-concept. And their personal identity. Because you'll learn when we talk about borderline personality disorder, they tend to want to identify with somebody close to them. It's called a identity diffusion. Also under your mental status examination is how they handle stress and coping. What kind of techniques have you used in the past? And the final thing, or sometimes it's the first thing, depending on why the patient came in there, is a risk assessment. Are they suicidal or are they homicidal? But you always, always, no matter what they came in for, ask them about that.
In the interview, is it best to ask for that at the end, or does it matter?
Like I said, it depends. You know, if they came in suicide, emphasized it, and then all of a sudden you're told it's blue, can that belief be changed? Yeah, it can with a cognitive person, because you say it's blue and you say it's blue. You know, a lot of different people besides just your family, okay? That's just example, bizarre examples, but.
With someone who does have like a cognitive disability, like if the people who like taught them those things had like, you know, that like change, could like they help those people?
Uh-huh.
You know, like if their parents had like a change of heart about being racist or something.
Right.
And they were like, oh no, it's actually okay for different colors.
Definitely.
So that, okay.
Definitely, yes.
But they won't just accept that from anybody.
That's what a schema is. Mm-hmm. I want y'all to see schema and recognize that that's what one is, okay? But that's how mental disorders develop, okay? The other thing about that chapter is, like those interventions, when you're doing these type of therapies, a lot of times what's used, okay? And one is a miracle question, okay? If you woke up tomorrow and all your problems were gone, tell me how your life would be different. Well, that would be a miracle if she woke up tomorrow and all her problems were gone, right? Okay? So, it's getting her to think through things to possibly change a better outcome. Okay? An exception question. Tell me when there's a time in your life when you haven't been sad. If you say you're sad all the time, most of the time, tell me of an event in your life when you haven't been sad. That's an exception question. And then scaling questions, y'all know what that is. On a scale of 1 to 10, tell me how sad you are, okay? And why you would give it that number. And then relationship questions, you know, that goes back to tell me how this person has an impact on you feeling this way. Okay? So, those are all type of common questions that are used in therapy. Sometimes patients are asked to do homework assignments like journaling. Because what are you doing when you're journaling and stuff like that?
You're thinking it out.
You're thinking about things and writing them down, and you're thinking them through. Bibliotherapy is used a lot sometimes. Mm-hmm. Bibliotherapy is like if I sat here and read y'all something, and then I said, okay, tell me what that meant to you, what you just heard. You tell me what that meant to you, and tell me what that meant to you. You're taking this information that you've heard and you're applying it and learning from other people different perspectives, okay? And those are just some of the examples that you will see them use, hopefully, in your settings that you visit, and how cognitive behavioral therapy is a big, big, big component with these patients. I don't know if I've said it to y'all, but an example is antidepressants. Don't fall.
I did that the other day.
Antidepressants can be 100% effective. Right? Y'all agree with that?
But only, what, 60% or 40%?
On 40% of the problem. Okay? You got to change. You got to look on that other 60% with therapy. Can't therapize somebody and send them back, you know, into the same situation that contributed to their problem. Okay? All right. So that's most of chapter 10. Okay. cognitive behavioral therapy. Just know you're going to hear it over and over and over.
That's true.
Oh. Yeah, it's 12.
What time is it?
2:30.
Okay, we got a few more minutes. You said, y'all said now anxiety? I can tell y'all real quick some key things about that.
We haven't.
18. 18 is essentially the foundation. Okay, for anxiety and OCD and PTSD and a depression, and it's the foundation because it talks about stress. Okay, and how stress is often the trigger seeing people develop, if not full psychological problems, emotional problems, okay? And some of the key things about that chapter is the goal with stress is learning to ultimately how to do what?
Manage. Cope.
Okay, but you...
Effectively.
What's the end goal using those coping skills?
To be able to
skills?
Function in your regular life with the stress.
To adapt. Adapt's the word I'm looking for. Okay? Because you want to adapt. Because if you don't adapt, there's going to be problems, right? Mm-hmm. And you use those coping skills to help you adapt efficiently. Because y'all think about it, there's basically two coping skills that are used widely when we're faced with stress. One is problem focused, and another is emotional focused. So generally, y'all are fixing to have a test. What's going to happen if you use a problem focused coping response?
Gonna study.
Okay, I have a problem coming up. I got a big test. So, what am I going to do about it? Well, I'm going to study. And I'm going to email Dr. Alexander if I have questions and don't understand something. You know, you cope by focusing on the problem. Now, what if it was emotion focused? What might happen?
Crying in a corner.
Oh, I can't handle this. I'm so stressed. I don't know.
You sound like me talking to my mom.
Forget it. I'm just gonna quit.
It's
not gonna help me.
Okay, this happened right before this exam.
No, this is like 60-40.
Literally, I sound like once a week.
So, this is a good example. I was here with the students last Friday, okay? And I was up here in this room while they were out there in their little areas. And all of a sudden, this human resource person, and I was having a big conference after a while. We were going to have to talk because James was coming in, and we were doing a case study. So I was getting that all lined out, and this person walks in and is very surprised and says, are you in here? And I said, well, yeah, you know, James gave this to me and students, I'm a nursing instructor. I got some employees that need to use a computer to test, okay? So how do you think I felt emotionally?
Frustrated.
Frustrated. Pissed. Okay? And if I would have acted on that emotion focus to cope, what might have happened?
Punched him right in the face.
James, I cannot believe this. You gave this room to me, and now I'm having to move my students. You know, I could got very upset, very ugly, caused some hard feelings between me and James, but that was my initial emotion. Okay? I was pissed. But, I mean, I was nice to the guy. You know, Well, sure, let them use their computer if this is the only room you have. I understand this is y'all's facility, but inside I was feeling pissed. That was my emotion. I didn't have any control over that emotion, but I had a control over how I responded. But instead of saying, hey, we got a problem, so what are we going to do? Well, I'm going to have to pack up everybody, and we're going to have to find somewhere else to go. And we did. A problem focused to cope, and things came out better, right? Okay. So that's the big two issues of that chapter. But you're going to see that people react on the, they use their emotions to cope because they're not understanding. Because they feel that way, they feel like they're justified and that's the right way to handle things. And you're going to see that with your patients and everything.
I was just thinking about adolescent boys where they kind of handle everything with fights.
They're boys.
Well, and that's the main thing I want y'all to get out of that chapter. Okay? And if there's something else, and I can't remember right off the top of my head, it's mainly one of those chapters to help you, yeah, build your foundation. Like, chapter 8 was to y'all to review the brain and just learn about those main neurotransmitters, because you're going to hear them brought up again. But with anxiety, real quick, because I know y'all are ready to go. We can still meet tomorrow if y'all want to, or we can just...
Wednesday.
Y'all let me know. But anxiety, and I'll go post those right now. When I go back to the school, I'll get those posted for you. Know those stages of anxiety, mild, moderate, severe, panic disorder. And with anxiety, OCD, and PTSD used to be a form of anxiety, kind of fell out under that anxiety umbrella, but nowadays the DMS-5 recognize them as their own separate problems, okay? But both of those things do have an anxiety issue with it. Mm-hmm. Know that you're not going to try to do a bunch of teaching with somebody who's experiencing moderate or severe anxiety. You could possibly do it with some mild anxiety. Because I'm sure even when y'all sit down to listen to one of my voiceovers, you have a little mild anxiety, like, oh, am I going to catch what she really wants me to get from this? Am I going to take it in? Okay. You can teach during mild anxiety, but you want to get that anxiety as low as possible for effective teaching to occur. As a nurse practitioner, I can't tell you how many times a doctor would come in and say, you have to have surgery. We got to do surgery on your back. Okay? And this is what's going to happen. Da 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 da. Well, after that point where the doctor said you need to have surgery and this is what we're going to do, it did this. And when that patient came back for their history and physical for me to do the medical part before surgery, I always sat down and went back over everything that the doctor said, and they hardly remembered hearing any of it because their anxiety had jumped from here to here all of a sudden when they heard the word surgery. So I can't stress that enough. So somebody that is in a full-blown panic disorder, think of the physiological changes that occur with anxiety. And somebody that's full-blown panic, what are you gonna have to do first, physically? Make sure it's not a heart attack, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, because most of the time they can't breathe good, they're having chest pain. So now, I don't care how many times they've come through your ER with a panic attack, and this is their 10th time, you still need to make sure it's not a heart problem this time. Now, think somebody who's having full-blown panic. Are they safe? No. So one of the number one things you want to do is stay with them. You need to stay with them. Stay with them. Okay? And you have to use simple, calm instructions. Are you going to ask them, well, tell me about how you're feeling right now. How did you get to this point? No, it's useless. Maybe when they get back down the baseline and calm down, you can go back and revisit that, but not at that point. Okay? So, panic disorder is one of the big anxiety things that you will encounter. Generalized anxiety disorder is another one. What is generalized anxiety disorder? What is the key word I'm looking for?
Generalized.
These people do what a lot?
Overthink.
Worry.
Worry.
She got it. Worry. But you're kind of on the same track by overthinking everything. Mm-hmm. It makes them worry. They worry about everything. Okay? Those are chronic worriers. They have generalized anxiety disorder. And your next one are your phobias. They're a type of anxiety. Y'all have heard of arachnophobia? Okay. Now, the main thing I want y'all to be careful with is don't confuse social phobia with agoraphobia. What's the difference?
Agoraphobia is outside.
Like fear of leaving your house?
No, that's fear of people, isn't it?
What's social phobia?
Social is like with the interactions with people. One of them isn't it just like they don't like people at all. Like no.
Agoraphobia is fear of outside or like leaving your house.
That's what I thought.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Social phobia is they can go out and function, but interacting with society and whatever they might have to do, like, oh, get up and tell us a few things. You know, the fact that they're going to have to talk to a bunch of people can make their anxiety start climbing, okay? And they're just very uncomfortable being out amongst people. They don't like to go to parties. Okay, because they're always afraid they're going to say the wrong thing, or they'll go, but they may stay like 5 minutes and then find an excuse to leave. Okay, they just have that social phobia. Whereas agoraphobia, they can't even leave the house. It's that bad. They try to step outside the house on the sidewalk and their anxiety just starts going sky high. Okay. That's the difference. But that's your phobias, and that's another section of anxiety that are common forms of anxiety that you will see. So, what medicine are you going to get for acute anxiety?
Benzodiazepines.
A benzodiazepine. Y'all tell me some examples.
Diazepam.
Your Pams and Lambs. Okay. What is wrong with them taking a benzodiazepine daily, every day?
It's addictive.
Addictive? What's some teaching you're going to do with them?
You don't want to, work in, motorized vehicles.
Yeah,
right.
Sedative.
Okay. Sedative effect. You don't want to mix it with what?
Alcohol.
Wine.
CNS depressant.
They're both CNS depressants. Okay? So, somebody that has to withdraw from benzodiazepines.
I say taper.
They need to taper. So, they probably should be where?
Hospital.
In the hospital. Okay? If they have to detox off of benzodiazepines. Because they can start experiencing seizures okay, and everything, and die, just like with alcohol, because they're both central nervous system depressants. So if y'all remember anything, alcohol and benzodiazepines, the two you need to be in the hospital to detox off of. Now, and I'm talking about somebody that's been abusing and dependent, and they need to get off of it. So, what is the first line drug of choice for anxiety? SSRIs. Okay. But how long does it take them to work?
About 7 days. No, that's when you start initially
like
feeling something, but a few weeks.
It's
like 2 to 3 months.
4 to 6 weeks, generally. Okay. But, yeah, some of them, I do agree with you, take a long, a little longer time. So they take a while to get in there. But why are they first line?
Because they can be given for chronic anxiety rather than acute.
And they're safe. They've got a good safety profile. Okay, you don't have to worry about addiction. Mm-hmm.
They can function on them.
Right.
Yeah, nice.
Okay. So they're first line, but you have to be careful about. You got to teach them about what. What syndrome?
Serotonin. Yeah.
Okay. So you need to know what over counters are taking. Are they taking St. John's Wort?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are they taking melatonin at bedtime, you know, when they're on an SSRI, that can increase the risk for serotonin syndrome. Okay? Tell me some examples of SSRIs.
Fluoxetine,
which is Prozac.
Sertraline,
which is Zoloft.
I don't know the brand names.
Paroxetine, which is Paxil. Okay? Mm-hmm. Those are all different examples. Start learning them, recognize them, because, you know, fluoxetine's just gonna be on your NCLEX. Okay, also with anxiety, I'm trying to think. I think we hit the key points with that. Main thing is stay with them if it's severe anxiety or panic disorder. Simple, concise. You know, don't try to over teach. Just give simple instructions. Gotta save that teaching for later. Now, OCD is a form of anxiety in a way, like I said, because that is why they do those compulsions to handle their anxiety. In a nutshell, obsessions are constant thoughts, unwanted thoughts about something. And it's generally something the individual would never even dream about doing. But that thought just keeps popping in their head. And that's why it drives them crazy. Because it's an obsessive thought that they just can't get out of their head. Okay? And then the compulsions is where they do that ritual over and over and over and over. And you think of the germophobic that washes their hands all the time. Okay? And they have got to do it. If they don't do it, their anxiety is going to climb. And they're going to become what? More stupid. So, somebody that comes in the hospital with OCD that has to wash their hands 3 times a day, okay? I mean, 3 times each time they go to the bathroom with a different bar of soap. Are you going to immediately make them stop doing that?
Mm-hmm.
No. You have to go at it slow. Well, this soap is very harsh on your hands. You know, we don't want your hands to get dry. Let's use this moisturizing soap. At least one of the times. Then I'll let you have your soap to the other times. And instead of doing it three times, let's try it just two times. And get them to think about what's going on. What are they thinking? How are they feeling when they have to do this compulsion? Okay? But you can't just expect them to stop cold turkey. That is not realistic. They still have to do those compulsions, okay? But you do want to do everything in your measure, because you do have to think about the physical. You know, if they're chronic hand washer, they're going to be drying out their hands and could possibly cause skin irritation, skin breakdown. So you've got to think about that aspect of it. But again, they do the compulsion as a form of controlling the anxiety that they're experiencing. And then you, anybody that has OCD, you have to look for those other disorders that are a form of OCD, like trichotillomania. Do y'all know what that is? And they pick their hairs out. Usually it's the eyebrows. Excoriation syndrome.
Mm-hmm, they scratch.
Okay. Hoarding. Hoarding is actually a form of OCD. Even though, you know, you think somebody who's extremely clean with OCD, hoarding is a form of OCD. Okay. That's the germophobic is just one example. And body dysmorphic disorder is the other one. They, something about them, they absolutely think is wrong, and they keep working on it. They have plastic surgery after plastic surgery to try to fix it, or, you know, they're just obsessed with the part of their body that they think needs to be corrected. And that's what that is, and it's a form of OCD. Can y'all think of somebody famous that had body dysmorphic syndrome?
Michael Jackson?
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yep. Oh, he messed up his body
like
that, real
like,
bad.
I think about that Ken doll guy.
Oh, well, yeah. he's a she about. Now.
Yes, yeah. I can't follow him. He had a lot done on his face.
But so, Michael Jackson went so far.
That's
kind of
OCD
Moses.
In a nutshell. All right? Any other questions?
I have a question about OCD. I had a friend that she like had issues with symmetry on her, like symmetry in general. Like whatever happened over here had to happen over here. I remember we were taking our fundamentals of engineering exam and there was a kid tapping a pencil on one side and she just left the test. Like she just couldn't deal with the room because it was tapping. And is that a form of OCD? I mean, she went as far, like, she accidentally burned her arm here, and she sat here staring at it, like, rocking back and forth, took the cigarette and burnt the other side so that they would match. I mean...
To me, it could be, but there's also what's called obsessive-compulsive personality disorder, and they do it more for control.
Okay.
Okay? Although it falls under that anxiety, fear, they're not necessarily doing compulsions or rituals.
Okay.
It's that they're the people that, like, this has to match.
Yeah.
Okay, for control, to show that I'm in control of how, you know, they're the ones that you see everything alphabetized.
Yes.
There has to be
yeah.
control in their house.
Oh, her books were just like, her books were
alphabetized. My college roommate, her closet had to be perfectly color coordinated. And one of my friend messed with it once just to mess with her and she lost it. Like, it was,
really?
Yeah.
Yeah. That can be very mean people.
Yes. Yeah. She snapped.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. My best friend, she just, her baby's one now. But like, even his ritual, like, if it comes out of step, like, and especially with COVID right now, like, they had to change everything because he couldn't, you know, go to his play dates on whatever day of the week. And it was just like, she had such a strict schedule and like, all that, like, COVID, like, messed it up, and so she had to, like, start going to therapy again, because it just messed with everything, and, like, she was, like, upset, and she was getting argumentative with, like, everyone, because she was out of, like, she didn't have control of those situations, so.
Okay. Any other questions? Did I miss a chapter?
No. Okay. Ms. Pollard said for us to give our...